Last but not least is Cameco Corporation. Presenting for Cameco is Ms. Alice Wong. She's Senior Vice President and Chief Corporate Officer with oversight for investor, corporate, government, and regulatory relations and corporate social responsibility. Alice has worked with Cameco for more than 25 years and has experience in a number of areas, including marketing, corporate development, strategic planning, and communications. And again, Alice, you know, after Fukushima, the uranium market has been in a bit of a turmoil, and you guys being, you know, the stewardess of the uranium industry, always looking forward to hear updates on your views in the market and what's new with Cameco and its growth plans to W.
Well, thank you, Oscar, and thank you to Merrill Lynch for having Cameco here today to speak about the industry and a little bit about our company. I first want to send regrets. Ken Seitz was slated to come to this conference and had a family medical emergency, and I think things have stabilized, but he sends his regrets that he's unable to attend the conference. So for those of you who don't know Cameco, we are one of the world's largest uranium producers with operations around the world. We're also a leading provider of services required to produce fuel for nuclear power plants, and we have an interest in Bruce Power, which provides power for the province of Ontario in Canada. I am now, at this point, must pass along, I'm sure you've seen this on every presentation, our friendly reminder that information in this presentation will be forward-looking, some of it. It's based on a number of assumptions and that actual results could differ materially. Please refer to our annual information form and the MD&A for factors that could cause these different results and the assumptions that we have made. Before I get into the specifics of Cameco, I'd like to start by looking at the uranium market and the energy market, which drives our business. It's, I know, as Oscar said, top of mind for you, given the changes in the market in the past last year or so. I think it's important to start by looking at the big picture for nuclear, and the big picture for nuclear is that it's a very long-term picture. This is a long-term industry, and the fundamentals that drive it have not changed that much over the year. Some 50 years ago, to provide some background, utilities started to use nuclear reactors to power their grids because they needed safe, clean, reliable, and affordable energy, and they needed more of it. That need has not diminished over the years and has, in fact, increased in recent years as more focus has been put on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and ensuring energy security. An even bigger contributor to this need is the world demand for energy in general. Since the 1980s, global electricity consumption has tripled, and it is forecast to almost double again over the next two decades. Understandably, the largest growth is coming from countries with rapidly expanding economies. And to put this into perspective, there are 7 billion people on the planet, roughly. Of that, 2 billion do not have access to electricity, and more who have access to only a fraction of the electricity that we use here in the Western world, and they are demanding more. As with any industry, there have been ups and downs in the past 50 years, and I can say from my 25 years in the industry, it's been up and down, and public support has come and been stronger and a little bit weaker. But the world reactors have continued to produce energy efficiently and affordably. As a result, many utilities around the world want and need nuclear in their energy portfolios, so much so that over the past decade, we started to see construction of new reactors, the magnitude of which has not been seen for many years. The pace of that construction accelerated to the point where today, dozens of reactors are being built around the world and increasing the need for more uranium. The challenge for the industry, as Oscar has mentioned, is the near and midterm uncertainty that has arisen from the events of Japan last year. At that point, all countries with nuclear programs paused to review the safety of their operations and to conduct stress tests, which has led to delays, some delays in the licensing and construction. Some countries, most notably Germany, as most of you probably know, over time has decided to move away from nuclear and focus on other ways to generate electricity. And Japan, as of very recently, has no reactors operating. The result is that the supply and demand, which is usually a fairly simple equation, has become a bit more complicated, and there is a concern about the possibility of excess inventories entering the market, and the utilities have been in a wait-and-see mode. Today, this is how the industry stands, while those issues get sorted out, which we are watching closely. But with regard to the Japanese fleet, we believe that the reactors will eventually come back online and that Japan remains committed to nuclear energy. We have, Cameco itself has partners, Japanese utilities partners in our Kintyre and our Cigar Lake project, and they are very clear that they're committed to these projects and they want to remain in the business. So I think that that's a very positive signal for the future of the Japanese fleet. If we look beyond Japan, we will see that most countries are continuing to grow their programs, and some of them are, they're looking at continuing their programs, and some of them are looking at growing their programs. With regard to the long-term market outlook, which is the real story for this industry, 96 net new reactors are expected to come on by 2021. 63 of them are already under construction. Most significant are countries like China and South Korea. We see some growth. But China is where the big growth is expected to come. Today, they have 14 nuclear power plants in operation and 26 under construction. And they have many, many more planned. Even here in the U.S., there are new nuclear builds planned. The U.S. government recently granted the first license in 30 years for construction of two new plants at the Vogtle site in Georgia. This, we believe, is good news for Cameco and good news for the industry. More reactors mean more demand for uranium, but it's also to remember that demand for uranium has long outpaced supply production. For example, last year world consumption was 165 million pounds. Production was 143 million pounds. Thus far, secondary sources of supply, such as that coming from the Russian Highly Enriched Uranium Agreement, or the HEU agreement, has filled the gap. But these supplies are diminishing, and the HEU agreement itself is coming to an end in 2013. When that agreement ends, it takes 24 million pounds off the market. That is equivalent to almost 15% of last year's consumption. So it's a big source of supply that will be gone. New supply will be needed to fill a gap that already exists and is expected to grow as a result of new reactors, which will raise the question and has raised the question, where will this production come from? The challenge is that our industry has such long lead times and has the inability to really respond quickly to demand. Uranium mines in general are very difficult to bring on at the best of times, and now with lower uranium prices, we are seeing cancellations and delays as new projects are becoming uneconomic. As a result, the industry could face significant supply challenges and a widening supply-demand gap in the not-too-distant future. And that's why, and we'll turn a bit more to Cameco now, we are pursuing our goal to increase our annual production from just over 20-some million, 21 22 million pounds to 40 million pounds by 2018, so that we can be in a position to respond when the customers call for more uranium. As we are well prepared, we have world-class assets in Canada, the United States, Australia, and we contain an extensive base of mineral reserves and resources. Today, we have 435 million pounds of proven and probable reserves, 254 million pounds of measured and indicated resources, and 317 million pounds of inferred resources. These assets are the foundation of our strategy and one of the primary reasons why we are a leader in our field and confident about our future. Our uranium segment delivers up to almost 70% of our business, and in 2011, delivered a record revenue of $1.6 billion for the company. In 2012, we expect to produce a total of 21.7 million pounds of uranium, and I'll show you now where that uranium is to come from our production centers. McArthur River in northern Saskatchewan, Canada, is our flagship operation. The average ore grade there is almost 17%, which is 100 times the world average. This just simply means, in very, very simple terms, that we can produce more uranium from much less ore. This mine gives us consistently good mine production, and this year we expect our share to be 13.1 million pounds. The total production from this mine is 18.7 million pounds. To put that into context, that mine alone produces about 13% of the current world production. And we continue to expand this operation by transitioning to new mining zones using our innovative freezing technique, which will allow us to develop in the Athabasca sandstone. In Kazakhstan, we have our Inkai operation, which is a joint venture that gives us a significant access to another significant deposit at a low cost. Inkai is expected to produce 2.5 million pounds for us in 2012, and we continue to pursue increased production at that project. We signed a memorandum of agreement with our partner, Kazatomprom, to increase annual production to 5.2 million pounds on a 100% basis, and we are in discussions to increase future annual production to 10.4 million pounds. Then there's Rabbit Lake, also in Saskatchewan, Canada, and our U.S. operations, which are also solid producers and an important part of our strategy. Rabbit Lake, which I'm sure you've heard our CEO refer to as our Energizer Bunny, is the mine that keeps on giving. We have mined over 186 million pounds from that site, and that was over the past 36 years. And we expect to continue through to at least 2017. We are expecting 3.7 million pounds from that mine in 2012. In the U.S., our operations are in Wyoming and Nebraska, and they continue to serve us well. These facilities are expected to produce 2.4 million pounds in 2012, and we are pursuing expansion around those facilities at satellite mines as well. At Cigar Lake, we have a very exciting project under development. It is the largest undeveloped high-grade deposit in the world. It has an average reserve grade of about 18%. So combined with McArthur River, we like to look at them as the two richest ore bodies on Earth. At full production, this mine is expected to produce 18 million pounds annually. Our share of that will be 9 million. We have made a lot of progress towards first production in 2013, which is topped off by a breakthrough of Shaft 2 earlier this year. The scale of progress is difficult to envision if you haven't been to the mine, but the images on the screen should give you a bit of a look at what we're talking about. At the top image, you'll see the area as it was in September of 2011, and then the same area, which is the bottom photo, in March. So in a few short months, that area has been completely transformed and is almost ready for production. So we're getting close. We also released an updated technical report in February that incorporates more comprehensive knowledge about the geology of the ore body and the changes that we made to improve the project, such as surface freezing and the milling agreement that we signed to have the ore all processed at Areva's McLean Lake Mill. The most significant result of these developments is an improvement in the economics of the project. The estimated average cash operating cost is expected to decrease from about $23 per pound to $18.60 per pound. So we're very pleased with that, and this will benefit the shareholders. Of course, we need to keep replacing the pounds that we mine, and we are preparing for future growth. To do that, we are expanding at many of our operations in Canada and in the U.S., and we're evaluating two new projects. The Kintyre project is in Western Australia and is a deposit that will add diversity in our geographic reach and mining methods. We plan to have a pre-feasibility study completed for the project later this year. In Saskatchewan, we are finalizing the feasibility study for our Millennium project. If it moves to development, this project will allow us to capitalize on existing milling capacity that's in the Athabasca Basin in Saskatchewan. We recently came to an agreement to purchase Areva's interest in the Millennium Project, which is expected to increase our ownership to between 58 and 70%, depending on whether our other joint venture partner exercises its first right of refusal. Ongoing exploration is also important to us, so we have a direct interest in almost 75 active exploration projects in 9 countries. Our approach to obtaining assets has been and continues to be strategic, planned, and disciplined in order to remain one of the world's lowest cost and largest producers well into the future. And though the focus of our business is the uranium segment, we are also invested across the nuclear fuel cycle. This diversity supports our uranium segment and helps us to better serve our customers and expand our market share while also supporting our W goals. We're always looking for opportunities to enhance and complement our business. We came across one such opportunity quite recently. You may have seen the news release that came out a couple days ago. And this is the acquisition of the NuChem Group, which is one of the world's leading traders and brokers of nuclear fuel products and services. This acquisition complements Cameco's business by strengthening our position in the nuclear fuel markets and improving our access to unconventional and secondary sources of supply. We are very excited about this development, and we believe it will be another tool, an excellent tool for us in our toolbox as we continue to grow our company. But of course, the goal is to put all these assets to work and to achieve results and to deliver value to our shareholders. And last year, we did demonstrate that we are very capable of doing that. We achieved a number of performance records in a very challenging environment. We continue to deliver good results in Q1 as well. This is largely due to our contracting strategy, which is designed to protect us through periods of uncertainty. We have targeted a weighted mix of contracts that have 60% of the amount which will be tied or linked to market pricing at the time of delivery, and 40% of the portfolio has pricing that is fixed and escalated over the time. So this gives us stable cash flow with predictable sales and some exposure to the upside when market prices increase. As a result, we have had strong earnings, consistent cash flow, and a solid balance sheet that supports continuing growth we believe that will be needed for the future demand. Which brings us back to where we started, considering the future of the nuclear industry and uranium demand. What I hope that I have imparted to you today is that the future for Cameco remains positive, that the world energy situation remains unchanged. The world needs large quantities of clean, reliable, and affordable electricity, which will be needed to meet future demand. Nuclear power offers a proven, technically mature solution on this criteria. All the evidence points to the continuing importance of nuclear energy and an increasing demand for uranium. Cameco will play and continues to play a leading role in supplying uranium to customers, old and new alike, for many years to come. Thank you very much for your interest and for taking time to listen to what we would call the Cameco story, and I'd be very happy to take any questions you might have.
To get to Moji there at the back, we asked this question to Uranium One, Chris Sattler. This, with the events in Fukushima and the nuclear reactors in Japan just coming to a stop. There's different estimates in the market with regards to inventories. And so, understand that 24 million pounds of HEU material will come to an end in 2013. But how do you factor those inventories, and how do you see that, affecting the fundamentals of uranium, which we think are going to improve in 2013? Would that delay, the price response? How do you see in that market?
What I would say is that the utilities do hold a certain amount of inventory, and that we have to assume that, we fully expect that those reactors will come back online, the ones that are still operable, and that over time, when we see the first restart come, then you'll see more to come. So the inventory that they hold would be, we don't have we're not going to disclose the exact number, but we have a sense of how much they would be holding. And I think, in the the past, they've held about 2 to 3 years worth of demand in inventory. And so if they have that, and they've been very working with producers and working well to make sure that they manage the inventories. So we haven't seen any large amounts of inventory coming to the market from the Japanese utilities. We have worked with them to manage their supply because, you know, if their reactors are closed down, they obviously don't need the product right now. But we haven't. So with that respect, they've been behaving quite very responsibly, I'll put it that way. So if you look at that amount of uranium, you have to assume, I guess, the worst case is none of them come back on, then that inventory would start to come into the market or be managed through producers or brokers and traders, as it has been.
Okay, thank you. I had a question there in the back.
Just given that Cameco has a plan to double their production between now and 2018, if demand doesn't match supply, are you able to slow that down?
Well, one of the things is that it is a really long lead time to get the production to the 40 million pounds. So what we're doing is we're moving our projects through a number of stage gates. So it goes through pre-feasibility and feasibility, and then it has to go through the regulatory process. Absolutely. If when we get there at the time that we need to start the production, if the economics are not there to support it, we can slow it down. We can, you know, park it for a while. But we don't have to bring them on. What we found is that the last time the price had a bit of a run-up, which would have been in 2007 or so, you know, you can't quickly bring on production. So we know, we've learned from that, the timing and amount of effort that it takes to get new production ready to bring on. But certainly, if the signs are not there and the economics are not there, we won't bring it on.
There's one over here.
I have two questions. One, it is said that the Japanese are spending $100 million a day in fossil fuel, and that is creating a lot of pressure for them to start some of their reactors. Also, it is being said that Germany is, in fact, going to come out and start their two reactors as well. But that's one question apart, you know, what do you think about that? And the second question is, let's assume for a second that those reactors don't come back into the market. The expected capacity, those 2063 that are under construction, of which 26 are in China alone, is this something that's going to take 20 years to build, or is something that we should expect to see in the market in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years?
I'll answer your first question, which is, what do I think of the idea that some of the reactors are being brought back on because they need them for because Germany has brought some on in Japan? Is that right? I think that part of the challenge in Germany and in Japan is that they don't have other power that can easily come on or that is economic. So Germany, you may recall, did have a phase-out policy before this and had just declared not that long ago that they were going to reverse that policy and let the reactors run and extend them as needed. And then with Fukushima happening, they went back to their old policy. They will face the same challenge, is that how do you replace, I think it's like 30% of their electricity comes from nuclear. So how do you replace that? What do you replace it with, and when can you do that? Japan, we know, they need the nuclear power as well. They will face the same challenges. I think they're already predicting things like rolling blackouts and that for summer. So, you know, if they can go through the testing and prove and demonstrate they're safe, I think you'll see pressure to bring those reactors back on. And I think that'll be a bit of a movement that'll help bring clarity to the market. With your other question, China, you know, they are going to bring on, they say higher than this, but I think it's by 2021, it's another, the other 20, like it'll be within a decade that they can bring on at least that much that they're saying. But they've proven they can build their reactors and get them running in about 5 years or so. So they don't take as long as some of the other examples you may have seen.
There's one more question.
Sure.
Now, the new acquisition that Cameco just made this week, what kind of volatility will it introduce to your earnings stream?
That's a good question. I don't know about volatility. They trade, they broker trade, most of their deals are done back-to-back. And so so we can see it'll add some earnings. It'll be, I think, modestly, we've described it as modestly accretive. Starting in 2013, and it'll add cash flows and earnings, modest earnings. So I don't know that it would add a lot of volatility to the earnings. They've been in the market for some time, and they have their contracts in place, and they'll contract and sell like that. So I don't foresee a lot of volatility due to the acquisition.
Just one more there.
Thank you very much for a detailed presentation. I was just curious if you could share some thoughts on the DOE announcement of further uranium sales. It seems we have this dynamic in uranium. There's always these future deficits on the horizon, but in the near term, we either have the DOE selling more, which they did last year and again this year, and that big black box called secondary supply, which often yields a lot. Thank you.
The DOE inventory... at this point, we have the information that we know it sits at the end of last year, sat at about 45 million pounds. That's the estimates, I think, that have been out there. They have an arrangement with the enrichment plant there that they can bring in the uranium part of it. The limit was 10% of U.S. uranium requirements, so that equated to about 5 million pounds annually. So this recent, and I have to confess I don't have all the information on the recent announcement, but I believe it suggests that the limit can be increased to 7.5 million pounds. So you're right. I can tell you in the 25 years, I started my life in marketing, and I actually did the supply-demand forecast. So I can tell you that you're right. When you look at the supply-demand, there was this excess inventory that overhung the market back in the years when I was doing the work. And now the overhang would be the HEU agreement, which is about 24 million pounds off the market. The DOE inventory at this, what we know, it's finite. It'll come in, and so there'll be different amounts coming in, but at least there's an agreement around it. It's transparent. The difference these days, I'd say, compared to when I was doing analysis, is there's a lot more transparency around what's actually out there. As in inventories back when I did analysis, there really wasn't. You sort of did an estimate of what people had bought and why there was inventory in the market and about how much it was. So I'd say the market today is a little bit more transparent in that you know what the stockpiles are and you can make some estimation about how they'll do to come in. But the bottom line is that with these inventories starting to come down, you're going to need new production. You're going to need the price to incentivize production to come on. And that hasn't been the fundamental, that hasn't happened because of these inventories. But when the marginal cost of production of the last pound coming in starts to influence the supply-demand dynamics and the pricing structure, you should see the price reflect what it should in a normal commodity. It should be reflective of the cost. And at this point, it just isn't. I don't know if that makes, hope that answered your question.
Well. We don't have any more questions. Can you please help me thank Alice for her presentation? Thank you, Alice.